coming and joining us for this session. Alistair, for those that don't know, is an Assistant Commissioner in the SMSF Regulatory Branch with the Australian Taxation Office. Squarely in the SMSF section, and going to impart some of his knowledge with us today. Now, we're going to have a slight change in format. So originally Alistair was going to do a presentation, but we've actually moved this into more of a Q&A session that Alistair and I are going to have together. So I've prepared quite a few questions that we're going to go through in the next half hour with Alistair. And it's mainly around the areas of concern that the tax office has, or where the areas of focus actually is, but also on some of the impending commencements around Division 296 and Payday Super, particularly as they pertain to SMSFs. So just really just getting straight into it, Alistair, if you don't mind, what are the key areas that the tax office is actually looking at? Where are your compliance issues that your main focus and keeping everyone awake at the tax office?
Thanks, Liz, and good morning, everyone. It's always nice to be part of these sessions. So, look, our main concerns continue to be around early access, illegal early access of super. That's a continuing priority for us, alongside prohibited loans, which we'll talk a bit more about shortly, but they are increasing, and that's a significant area of concern for us. As you mentioned, particularly with Div 296, SMSFs failing to meet their lodgement obligations is an ongoing focus for us, and we're really increasing how we look at that. And we also have some concerns around the level of fraud we're seeing in the sector, given the size of the funds that are under management in SMSFs. Fraudsters are very keen to enter the system. Now, I did say before that I might do a bit of a crazy dance because I'm in a room which has got lights that switch off, which they just did. So if you see me doing this, I'm not trying to gain your attention. I'm just trying to turn the lights back on in the room.
All good. No, you're right. Look, and big areas, I'm going to sort of poke and prod. I'll ask you a few more questions about those areas. But if you don't mind, can we just start off with illegal early release? And I know the tax office has been doing a bit of research and has got some numbers around that one. So do you want to, or you're able to find some of your insights on what you're finding?
Yes, sure. So earlier, in February, we released the new estimate of illegal early access. So that related to our assessment of the 2023 financial year. And the figure there we estimate as approximately $252 million was illegally withdrawn without a condition of release being met. That's slightly higher than for 2022, which was $250 million. This is the fourth year we've done the estimation program, and it's pretty clear still that illegal early access is a persistent issue. But what is of greater concern following our work on the 2023 years is prohibited loans.
And so I want to ask you some more questions around prohibited loans. So what's the distinction? What's happening there?
So for the 2023 year, prohibited loans, we estimate there were $398 million in prohibited loans made in that year. That's up from $282 million in the 2022 year. Now, part of that discrepancy is caused by we included this year an estimate of loans done by those that have not lodged. So that figure was around $50 million. But the remaining $65 million, approximately $115 million increase. 50 of it is a result of a change in methodology, but the other 65 is still a significant increase on what we saw in the previous year. So that's a concern for us. And, you know, while a lot of the amounts are still repaid, members should not be accessing retirement savings by way of loans. And the scale and the increase highlights that there is significant compliance risk there, not only for us, but for the sector as a whole.
Wow. So 398 plus the 252.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Big numbers. So who's likely to do illegal early release? Is it any particular sector or characteristics? where people are more likely to engage in this?
Yeah, so our analysis shows that it's more likely to occur in newly established SMSFs. A lot of them were never intended to operate as legitimate superannuation funds, and they were really done to facilitate illegal early access. Sometimes that's through schemes or scams, which is concerning. And specifically, they're commonly related to promoters or intermediaries who target vulnerable individuals and charge excessive fees. So people should be on the lookout for that. We also know that it tends to be more those with balances under 200,000 that are most likely to engage in this kind of activity, and they account for just over 80% of the cases in our estimate.
Wow,
So,
that's a big number. It's a
yeah.
big number. Yeah. And so why do people do it? What are the main drivers for people doing either doing loans or illegal early release?
Look, there's a number of things at play. Financial stress is obviously one of them. Personal circumstances such as relationship breakdowns, but also a lack of understanding of SMSF obligations. So this promoters kind of tell them that it's okay to do these things, we don't, it isn't. And so those are the main three things that we see.
So coming back to prohibited loans, is it as simple as, and I suspect that in years gone by, there has been an element of where it sort of happened, you pay it back, you pay some interest and move on. Is it a case now, or in your view, can SMSF simply repay to fix the breach?
No, you can't. While getting the money back into the super system is important, it doesn't negate the breach of the actual loan. So the key messages for trustees is pretty straightforward on this. Do not access or lend fund assets in the first place. This is the only way to avoid the breach. Any payment that is neither a genuine loan nor a superannuation benefit paid in accordance with a condition of release would constitute illegal early access. So the only exception might be where a payment amount to a genuine mistake of fact, meaning that the payment was made to the wrong party or a wrong amount.
Okay.
In this case, the fund would have a legal right to recover it, and providing it is recovered promptly, it would not be considered IEA, so, and therefore not a reportable breach. Look, such things also can breach the sole purpose test under Section 62. It may also represent a breach of payment standards and regulations 6.17, as well as Section 65 breaches, which prohibit the provision of financial assistance to members. So, look. And unfortunately, we don't have any discretion to disregard or overlook breaches of the CISA legislation. So if those things occur, then we can't overlook them.
So thinking about the practicalities, so you sort of said there's still a breach even if it's actually repaid. Is there going to be a difference in outcomes if the trustee is if they don't repay it?
Yeah, so amounts not repaid will be treated as illegal early access and assessed to the member. So they're assessed as a super benefit, and taxed at the individual's marginal rate. They don't get any concession in terms of that. Making a voluntary disclosure would not change the taxation liability outcome, but depending on the facts of that case, it may assist in reducing any tax shortfall or CISA administrative penalties that would be applied.
Yeah, okay. So you're seeing some voluntary disclosures on this, obviously. Yeah, brilliant. Okay. So do you want to just give us a bit more flavour around how the ATO actually views these behaviours when people are, undertaking loans or illegal early
Yeah,
release?
so like we continue to take a firm approach. You shouldn't be accessing the funds in that way. A common sentiment we hear is that the super is my money, which is true at a basic level, but superannuation is money held in trust for retirement purposes. So unless you've met a condition of release, you should not be accessing those monies. There are not really any grey areas around that. They're clear breaches of the law.
And what action has the tax office taken? Have you got sort of, to
Look,
date, what has happened? Yeah.
where we identify breaches of Section 65, depending on the severity of the breach, how many times it occurs, we will impose CISA administrative penalties, or for more serious breaches such as large loans or those made over a number of years, we take firm compliance action. For instance, there was a recent AAT, sorry, ART case. I kept calling it the ART case, Alisa and Ramos versus the Commissioner, which was handed down in late-ish on the 21st of February. It's a good example of this. In this situation, the trustee had repaid the loans in full, but they were made over a number of years. We imposed CISA administrative penalties, and there were a number of other breaches that occurred, and so the tribunal upheld the disqualification of the trustee. So it's really important that people bear that in mind, that these are significant breaches. And I think it's also really important to note that breaches of Section 65 carry with it an administrative penalty of 60 penalty units, which is $19,800. So there's a significant administrative penalty associated with it, which gives you an idea of how the legislature and the government legislated the provisions feels about loans.
Absolutely, absolutely. You mentioned earlier before around frauds and scams and so on. So, with the tax office's approach to someone who had had illegally released because of they were a victim of a fraud or a scam, does anything change around how you would approach those scenarios?
Look, unfortunately, we can't do anything about the consequences associated with breaches of the CISA. But if it was through a fraud or a scam, we would be, and depending on other behaviours of the taxpayer involved, we would certainly look at reduction of penalties that might be imposed in those kinds of circumstances. But it's unfortunately the tax outcomes, there's nothing we can actually do about that. There's no discretion to ignore it. But potentially, if they've come to us quickly, done everything else they can, we would certainly look to reduce penalty.
It's really unfortunate, isn't it? That and as you said, that tends to be those people who've got less than $200,000, less subject to scam, the ones who can least afford it. And
That's right.
all right. I just wanted to come back to some of the non-lodgement issues that you were you mentioned earlier as well. That is a strong focus area for the tax office as well. And perhaps you can just sort of shed some light on why online lodgement is a priority area for the tax office.
So, timely lodgement is a key fundamental of compliance within the CISA rules. So, to use some idea of the scale, as at 31 December 2025, there were around 93,000 funds had one or more overdue lodgements, including 20,000 funds that had never lodged a return since they registered. Lodgement is how trustees demonstrate compliance with their legal obligations and how we monitor the integrity of the sector. So it's really important that people lodge and lodge on time. And if they think they're not going to be able to meet the lodgement due dates, as with many things, reach out to us so that we can help you work through that and ensure that, people are complying with their obligations. But if they need a bit more time to do it, don't just sit on your hands and kind of wait, reach out to us.
Yeah, and I think earlier engagement is critical, right? Don't wait, sort of wait until the due date, getting a little bit earlier.
Absolutely.
Cool. All right. So in helping the tax office, I get obviously tax agents have a strong role to play here as well. So what do you see as the SMSF advisor role in improving lodgement outcomes?
Look, it's critical that they engage early with trustees. That really helps in getting an understanding of their personal circumstances. Communicating clearly with their clients about when the due dates are and what needs to be done and what they need, and supporting year-round organisation and record keeping rather than just a mad panic when it gets close to the lodgement date. I have to admit that's a real do as I say, don't do as I do kind of a statement. But not that I've got an SMSF, but it te does tend to be a last minute kind of thing for me. But the few times I have managed to do it earlier, it's been a lot more less painful than.
Absolutely, absolutely. So what insights do you think that lodgement behaviour indicates?
Look, it's timely lodgement is a really strong indicator for us that they're operating within the rules and the regulatory boundaries. The highest group we have is the Never Lodgers, and they're the funds that are established rollover super and then never lodge a return. And almost 40% of those funds go to on to illegally access their super, and the
Wow.
value of the legally accessed amounts in that group increased by nearly 40% last year. So not lodging is like we get the circumstances where you might go to create an SMSF, you think that's a good idea, and then you decide that actually, you know what, it's all too hard. But there's other ones that it's really just a mechanism to try and access the funds for whatever reason.
Yeah. Crazy. Practical steps that might help improve on-time lodgement.
Yeah, so engaging an auditor early is important, allowing time for thorough audits and early issue identification. So getting on the front foot with that, requesting completed documentation up front, including bank statements and valuations, encouraging year-round record keeping, as I said earlier, and maintaining regular communication throughout the year, so not just at year end. So this is particularly important with Payday Super and, as you mentioned, DIV 296 now being enacted coming along. So these steps will help particularly those funds with complex affairs to be timely with their lodgements and meet their other obligations. So yeah, that's key.
And I mean, you've got a lot of stakeholders in there, haven't you? That you've got your auditor has got to be involved. If you've got to get real estate agents for valuations and so forth, so you can't expect your urgency to be everybody else's urgency as well. So there's,
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Cool. Again, you've got a lot of SMSF professionals listening into this one. So are we subject to the same rules, or are we special?
You're probably special, but only in that we hold you to a higher standard than others. You should understand your obligations better than most. And so the expectations are consequently a bit higher. So no, there's no special concessions on that front. But I acknowledge that the vast majority of professionals do the right thing. Our message to you is to maintain strong compliance fundamentals, particularly around not accessing funds unlawfully. There is, however, a cohort of professionals we are aware of that have SMSFs themselves with lapsed obligations, and we are taking targeted compliance action to address this behaviour. So we're currently, for instance, reviewing around 20 auditors who each have one or more SMS annual returns outstanding for their own SMSF. So if they fail to comply with lodgement, these cases will be referred to ASIC. Tax agent, as I said, tax agents and auditors, you are held to a higher standard of care, particularly if you have your own SMSF. And that's only sensible given your knowledge and you're working in the system. So, but again, if the people online feel like they're not going to be able to meet those obligations, they should reach out to us as quickly as they can. We're always happy to try and help support people and support them when they're trying to do the right thing and understand that sometimes things get in the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your very point, I mean, tax agents, obviously, that's part of your tax agent registration is that you must have your own affairs, including your self-managed super fund, up to date.
Absolutely. Yep,
Lodgement, no,
correct.
no chat about it. All right. So, what can we do as tax professionals to assist our clients who won't lodge? And I think we all have them, despite best efforts to, rally them in. Don't.
So again, we encourage tax agents and professionals to maintain an understanding of the lodgement due dates and make sure their clients are aware of those due dates. It's also important to distinguish between those clients who can't lodge and because there are genuine issues and those that won't lodge. And where clients are uncooperative, agents must consider their own professional obligations and risk response exposure. We encourage your members and those online to support trustees in using the SMSF voluntary disclosure service. So that's where people can disclose to us that a breach may have occurred, and then we can work with them to fix any non-compliance that may have happened. And obviously, where people have self-declared that they have an issue, things like penalties and whatnot are more likely to be reduced in those kinds of circumstances. But agents can reinforce expectations through education as well, and targeted engagement and compliance action from us may occur where required. So,
right. I was going to ask a couple of questions on some of the auditors, but if you don't mind, I wanted to go to, and we've briefly mentioned that interaction between lodgements and Division 296.
Yep.
And probably for Payday Super as well, that criticality of on-time yep. lodgements and why that matters.
Yeah. So, yeah, like just before we get into that, I will talk about that, but both met, and there goes the lights again. So I'll just do my one. feel like the robot and Lost in Space. that might show my age a bit. But anyway, so both measures start 1 July 2026.
Mm-hmm.
But bear in mind with Payday Super, 1 July 2026 start date means first pay event after 1 July 2026, whereas BTSC is a financial year thing, so there's a bit more kind of lead time around most of that stuff than there is for Payday Super. But to get into the more specifics around Div 296, so the first assessments will follow the lodgement of the 2027 stars, and are based on expected due dates for that, and affected trustees won't see any assessments until early 2028. Or sorry, it's probably not the trustees, it's the members that will see the assessments. So just a bit more background on Div 296. The tax applies to the individuals whose total super balance exceeds the large super balance threshold, which is at the moment 3 million. It's an additional tax on the superannuation earnings attributable to the portion of the member's balance above the threshold. So that's a key thing that tends to get a bit missed. It's if you're over the 3 million threshold, you're not getting the additional tax on all the earnings of the fund. It's only that proportion of the earnings that relate to the balance over the 3 million. So that's a key element. Although it's assessed to the individuals, the SMSF trustees have important obligations where a member's total super balance exceeds the thresholds. The fund must calculate and report the realised earnings attributable to the affected member and provide that information to the ATO through the SMSF annual return. In some cases, trustees may need to engage an actuary to confirm the earnings attributable to the member's interests. That will be most likely to occur where there's more than one member. Obviously, if you've only got one member, that's pretty easy to deal with. In returning to your question about lodgement, it's important to note that Div 296 relies heavily on accurate and timely SMSF reporting. So although 296 is a personal tax assessed to the individual, similar to Div 293, the information needed to administer it, such as balances, earnings, and assets values, comes primarily from the SMSF annual return, and a significant proportion of those impacted by Div 296 either only have an SMSF or have a combination of an SMSF or APRA fund. For SMSF members, the ATO relies on the annual return to determine the total balance, the opening and closing balances, and the earnings attributable to the balances above the DIV 296 threshold. So the lodgements will be really critical as part of that process.
With APRA regulated funds, as I understand it, once the tax office has identified who's in or who's out by virtue of total super balance, they will then potentially approach those big funds to come up with the Division 296 fund earnings. For SMSFs, is it we are on the front foot with this and actually reporting that Division 296 fund earnings with the SAR, or will it be the same as APRA process as APRA funds?
So I think it'll be a combination of things, but we're still working through it.
Okay.
So obviously where the balance for the individual is over the $3 million threshold in the SMSF, then we would expect reporting on the SAR. So we're proposing changes for the 2027 year. But if there's an APRA fund and an SMSF, the balance in one may not be sufficient to push them over the threshold. So it's only until we get both numbers that we'd be able to determine and let the trustees know that we might need information about that particular
Probably a good thing that we're not reporting everybody's Division 296 fund earnings when it may never be appropriate for them.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah. So that
we can report when we know it to be true.
Yeah, and that's my understanding of how it will work, but we are still, it's still only relatively newly enacted, so we're still working through the exact way that will be administered, and we're using our liaison groups to work through how that'll happen.
Okay. So what do I have here? So changes to the 27 SAR.
Yep.
We'll expect some changes to come through that for the fund earnings as
yep.
appropriate. Excellent.
Yep.
And we've talked about the lodgements. Total super balance, how is it reported? Well, part of the SAR. So it's business as usual, really, isn't it?
Yeah,
That's
already reported now, so there's no change.
Yeah. And just on the capital gains component that applies to SMSFs,
mm-hmm.
So I'm particularly interested about the mechanics of making that election
mm-hmm.
to how we do it and kind of what perhaps comes into play there.
Yeah, so again, we're working through that. There's a few things, though, to bear in mind about this election, and I think also a bit of confusion in the community. So if you make the election, it only applies to your calculations of Div 296 liabilities. All your CGT will still be worked out using the old cost bases. So it doesn't reset the cost bases for CGT purposes and income tax purposes. It's only for working out your earnings for Div 296 purposes. We're continuing to work with our working groups around exactly what the election will look like. And we will be issuing web guidance shortly around that. But do bear in mind the election doesn't have to be made until the due date for the fund's 2027 tax return. So that's a bit about what I was talking about with Peter, the difference between a 1 July 2026 start date for Div 296 and 1 July 2026 start date for Payday Super. If you are going to make the election, it applies to all your CGT assets that you owned at 30 June. You can't cherry pick, much and all, as people I'm sure would like to be able to do that. It must be made in the approved form, and it's what's called an irrevocable election. So if you've made the election, you can't undo it, regardless of whether your circumstances change and you actually would have been better off without the reset. So it's also important to note that I've already said that only applies for Div 296 purposes. So,
we are just slightly over time, but just curious, is there anything else that's sort of key, given that Payday Super is imminently and it does have kind of immediate implications?
Yeah.
Is there any key messages that you've got for us
around
that one?
So I think there's a bit of a misconception that maybe Payday Super doesn't impact SMSFs. There are two really key things that SMSFs need to do, and that is make sure that they've got an electronic, active electronic service address, because the way the system is changing, employers will be pinging and they'll get error messages back. If they get error messages back because of the tight turnaround times, they won't have time to necessarily fix those issues, and they will likely make the payments to their default funds. Now, while the individual is not losing the SG contribution, it's then a pain for them to have to roll it into the SMSF. It's also important that the fund has activated the new payments platform. So that's the OSCO platform, so that they can get very quick transfers of monies into the accounts. Now, it may be, I think it's important to bear in mind that if the payments are from a related entity, that's kind of a bit of a different story, but about 25% of funds actually have a member who is receiving SG payments from an unrelated party. So it's not a small number of SMSFs that are potentially caught up in this. And there may well be some teething problems. Everybody's not going to get it sorted, but it is important to encourage your clients to make sure that by 30 June, they've got their active ASA and they've got the OSCO payment system activated in the SMSF's account, so it can receive those quick transfers, because employers don't want to get caught up with an SG penalty. And again, the commissioner has very little ability to remit those kinds of things. Light's gone out again. Hopefully this is being recorded and you can substitute over some AI-generated wording as to what I'm doing or music. Those are probably the two main points, Liz.
And I think it's an important one, Alistair, and it's, you sort of think it's around the employers and but there is such a key piece that SMSFs have to play.
Absolutely. And because there's now error messaging in SuperStream, when they go to lodge the payment, if it doesn't match, it'll bounce. So they'll get an error message back. They will be testing it, some of them, beforehand, so they can do it before an actual pay event. Yeah. But really key to make sure that those things are in place for the SMSF, but also that the details of the member are up to date with the employer.
Definitely. All right, we are a few minutes over time. So thank you very much, Alistair, for agreeing to be part of this presentation today. We very much appreciate it. Just a reminder for all our delegates, if you can complete the evaluation form in the attendee hub, that would be greatly appreciated. And then we're going to take a break now for about half an hour, but we'll be back for session 3, Pensions and the New Dimensions with Julie Steed. And that starts at 12:30 Australian Eastern Daylight Savings Time. We're starting at 12:30 sharp. So thanks again, Alistair. Take care.
Thanks very much, Lucy. All the best, everyone.